You better hustle if you want to get a line. We'll get one for you coming up as we start to answer the calls. Sad to the story of Robin Gibb, right? That happened a little while ago. In our month in between visits here on Coast to Coast AM. Remember, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I've got another chapter I've got to turn into. I actually got like five more chapters. I got to finish editing of the manuscript that I've got coming out in spring of 2013. It's funny how early you have to get these texts done. In any event, I promise as I finish these chapters, I'll be doing better on keeping in touch via Twitter. So I hope you're patient, and I look forward to continuing the conversation via Twitter. That's Deacon Punnett, DeaconPunnett, Deacon Punnett at Twitter. And then also too, I want to give a shout out to Ida at Central Presbyterian. She's probably not listening anymore, but I preached there earlier this morning and she came up to say hi. I should probably should have said that in the first hour before she conked out. But if you know Ida, tell her I said hi. And then let's roll. We've got another hour coming up. Very interesting story of the Aleppo Codices, or sorry, the Aleppo Codex. And I have an update on the Jordan Codices coming up in just a second, too. And that story of the James Ossuary, we'll get to that before the end of this hour. Maddie Friedman brought it up, but there's an aspect of that story we should go back and grab before we're done. And your calls next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so much to get to on Coast to Coast AM. Let's pick it up with who's been waiting the longest, and that's Shelley in Iowa for Maddie Friedman, the author of the Aleppo Codex, a true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. Shelley?
Hi, Ian.
Hey.
Boker Tov, Maddie.
Hi, Shelley.
I am so glad that you brought this subject up. I had never heard of it. I'm Jewish myself, and I've been to Israel four times. I had never heard of Aleppo Codex. And Ian, thank you so much for having this subject brought to light. And Maddie, you're wonderful, extraordinary. This ranks in probably the top three shows, and I've been listening for probably 15 years.
Well, I'm so glad you enjoyed it. You had a question for Maddie?
I do. You never told us whether the 80-year-old Mossad agent turned over the papers to you.
In the end, he did.
The book, right?
In the end, he did. The persistence paid off in that case and in a few other instances when I was trying to crack the story right at the beginning. And yes, in the end, the ex-Mossad agent, Rafi Sutton, did show me his documents, and it took a long time. I met with him probably more than a dozen times, and we developed a relationship. And not only did he turn over that file folder that I so wanted to get my hands on, but he also told me many of his stories, and he became a main character in the book, not only
Yeah.
of his experiences in the Mossad, but he was born in Aleppo. And he had seen the 1947 riot in Aleppo, the one where the Codex was thought to have been lost, as a teenager. And he later escaped to Israel. And the story of how he escaped, snuck over the border into Lebanon, and then escaped via sea to Israel. And it's a fantastic story about his escape from Syria. And that's also in the book. And I also included a third story, which is tangentially related to the story of the Aleppo Codex, but it's also just a great yarn when Rafi, the same ex-Mossad agent, was an intelligence officer in military intelligence in 1967 at the height of the Six-Day War. He was sent to Bethlehem, which had just been captured by the Israeli military, to retrieve one of the Dead Sea Scrolls called the Temple Scroll. It was obtained at the height of the fighting. An advisor to the Israeli prime minister sent a team from military intelligence, and Rafi was a member of that team, to Bethlehem, to the house of a dealer who was known to be holding a book called the Temple Scroll. And they obtained it during the war, and it is now in the Israel Museum. It's one of the most important of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that's also included in my book, both because it's a great story and because it's an indication of the importance that Israel has always attached to these ancient manuscripts.
It's a great, he's a great character, and I loved his, was he like 9 years old, right? His recollections of Aleppo or
Something like that.
something
He
like
really has a
that.
vivid memory of what happened, and he describes his childhood in Aleppo during the
Oh,
Second
that's
World
what it is.
War.
Yeah. getting the breads and going in between the bakeries and all the other stuff. It's really...
waiting in line. He remembers them. He remembers waiting in line for sugar, and it was particularly nasty sugar that used to leave a very unpleasant froth on the surface of the tea. Rationed war sugar. It was great. Right. He told me a few great stories.
Yeah, quite a character. George is in Tennessee. First-time caller line on Coast to Coast for Maddie Friedman, author of the Aleppo Codex. George?
Good morning. How are you, gents?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you. I just have a couple of questions. Once all this comes to light, how do you think it will affect the Jewish community?
That's a very interesting question. The book was just published, so the effects of the publication are just starting to be registered. I think a lot of people, like the previous caller, are learning about this book for the first time, which is great in itself, even if nothing else happens. People are learning about what is Judaism's most important manuscript and one of the most important books on earth that is of interest to anyone who's interested in the Bible or anyone who's interested in Middle Eastern history or anyone who's interested, I think, in Western culture. It's kind of one of the foundation stones of Western culture, and it's also a story that's very useful in terms of understanding the last millennium of history and understanding the modern Middle East and the state of Israel. So I think a lot of people are hearing about the manuscript for the first time.
Yeah, I like
it's also
to...
It's also possible that some information will arise as a result of publication that will help us find the missing pages, and that, of course, would be wonderful.
But even just to hear what Shelley, who identified herself as Jewish in Iowa, talk about diaspora, this was something she could connect to again without, but she didn't know what she didn't know. And so now that you know about this book, it becomes even more important somehow that it should eventually be restored. We've got Jeff in Culver City on Coast to Coast for Maddie Friedman. Jeff?
Yeah, hi, Ian and Mr. Friedman. Yeah, it's absolutely amazing that the Pentateuch has not only remained more or less intact after all these years, but has also been revered and quoted and co-opted by other religions. But my question, Mr. Friedman, is this. Why has the Christian Bible been routinely tampered with, beginning with Constantine deciding which books to exclude, like the Book of Thomas, Barnabas, and Mary, as well as these additions to the Christian religion, which includes the Mormon books? You know, I find that kind of odd, and I like your take on that.
That's an interesting question. I must say that's not my area of expertise. I don't think I think I'm far less qualified than Ian to answer that question. But certainly the process of choosing the canon is an important process that's reflected in Judaism as well. I mean, there's all kinds of books floating around at the time when they're putting together the Bible. And some of the books are included in the Hebrew Bible, and I'm just talking about the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. And 24 books eventually make the cut. 24 books, by the way, according to the traditional Jewish way of counting the books, which is different than the way Christians count those same books.
Yep.
Just for example, the Book of Samuel, in the modern way of counting, is two books, Samuel 1, Samuel 2. In their traditional Jewish counting, it's just one. So 24 books. So those books are included, and other books are left out because they're considered dangerous or they're considered not helpful. For whatever reason, books are included and left out, and that has a lot to do with the way people think at the time. In the case of the Jewish Bible, we're talking about 2,000 years ago, the text is canonized. And in the Christian Bible, it happens, of course, a few centuries later. And I'm sure the considerations were more or less the same, but I'm actually interested in hearing if Ian knows anything more about it.
Well, I'll say this. Of course, for both either the Hebrew scriptures or, if we're going to think of them too, as then the Christian scriptures, is you're always going to be leaving something out. So there is no way to have included everything. And then the argument is was there enough in that represented each community? And what you see in the Hebrew scriptures, for example, is a couple of different perceptions of God. Like there's different names for God that represented different communities within the growing Hebrew world. So you have, names and words that all say the same thing, all talk about the same thing, but from different perspectives. The same thing is paralleled later on in why some books are collected and some aren't. it's probably more political, but had less to do with Constantine as it just had to do with what is enough and when can we just close the canon? I mean, if we keep it open forever, then everyone's going to be able to keep adding things to it and it'll never stop. And so I think they were just trying to get to a place where they felt like this is good enough. And then the other texts would be out there too in some form or another. The fact that that he mentions the Gospel of Thomas is, it was a collection I like, and if you've never read it, Maddie, I think you might enjoy it. But it's just a collection of sayings by Jesus, and so it has no narrative. So it's unlike the other Gospels that have a narrative that go along with it, and that's one of the reasons why they say Thomas wasn't included. It wasn't necessarily that what is said is so explosive. It's just that it didn't have a story, and that's what they were.
I'm writing down the name of the Gospel of Thomas right now so that I can read it. But
you find it very interesting.
That's very much connected to the story of the Aleppo Codex, because in order to have a religion that kind of holds together, you said you need to, at some point, freeze Scripture. You can't have Scripture being altered, and you can't have Scripture being added to. Otherwise, you know, your religion is going to fall apart, basically. So at some point in time, and that could be, you know, even a randomly decided point in time, they decide, okay, listen, these are our books, and this is what we're going to work with, and that's how a religion sticks together for millennia in the case of Judaism and Christianity.
Sure. For better or for worse, these are our books. And we can have an Apocrypha, there can be other things that could be floating around, but let's just go with these and see how far that gets us. Let's go to, and by the way, to Gospel of Thomas is almost Kabbalistic. You'd enjoy it because it's that mystical end of Judaism is reflected very highly in these sayings.
That sounds very interesting.
It is good. It's way fun. Joe is in Palmdale on the wildcard line on Coast to Coast for Maddie Friedman, author of the Aleppo Codex. Joe?
All right. Yeah. Hey, Ian, how are you?
Couldn't be better. Thank you.
Mr. Friedman.
Hi there.
Yes. You know, I found in a source that the Zionist National Jewish Fund paid the Arabs and the Turks a pretty hefty sum of money for 255,000 acres, which is the land of Israel now. And so Israel has the right to be there, if not from an ideological point of view, but at least from a geographical landlord. They are the landlords, okay? So they own that land. And they have the right to be there. And I don't care what the Arabs or the Turks may say, that stands, okay? So there's no way of getting away of that. Now, I have to actually ask you a question. This is just a comment that I wanted to make, but I wanted to ask you a question. These codices, you know, that they find, that I've heard, you know, listened to all so far, you know, this most of them have some technical explanation of where they found, who read them and all, but what's actually in them? Where do they lean towards the existence of the state of Israel or towards Christianity? Or
I think we're getting a couple of things confused here. So we're the Jordanian codices was a conversation we were having just before the top of the hour, Joe. And that's a different, that's David Elkington. He's been on the show before a couple of times talking about that. Those are highly disputed books. Those are the metal books, the lead books. This is the Aleppo Codex, and it's a very different story. And if you get a chance to go back and listen to the podcast, I think you'd find it very informative. And it isn't controversial in that sense. There isn't any dispute of the authorship. There's a little dispute about the ownership, though, as the books make their way into Israel. And there's plenty of people still back in Syria that would like to see the Aleppo Codex repatriated, correct? Aren't there...
That's probably true. I think today they have more pressing problems.
Right. but there was a period of time when they were actively suing to try to get it back, weren't they?
The Syrian government tried to obtain the codex in the years around the riot in 1947, and that, as we discussed, is one of the main reasons that the Jewish community spread the rumor that it had been destroyed and spirited it into hiding, so that the government wouldn't be able to get its hands on it. And eventually managed to smuggle it out of the country and into Israel.
But what was it about the trial? What was the core of the trial that would...
The trial is a fascinating and part of the story. It's the heart of my book. The trial unfolds pretty bitter legal battle that unfolded in Israel between 1958 and 1962. And the trial is a battle for ownership of the codex.
That's what I was talking about, yeah.
The government of Israel and the community of Jews from Aleppo.
Right. That's what I was talking about.
And it's a very interesting trial because it centers on the surface, it's about a technical question, which is what was the courier who brought the codex to Israel told to do with the manuscript when he arrived? That's what the trial's about on a purely technical level. But actually, the trial is a battle over an interpretation of history because the state of Israel sees itself as a legitimate representative of the entire Jewish people. It had just been established. It's an incarnation of Jewish history. And it is the rightful repository for not only for all the Jews of the world, but also for the spiritual treasures that helped sustain the Jews in the diaspora. And Jerusalem, in this narrative, is the rightful place for Judaism's greatest manuscript. That's the approach of the Israeli government. The Aleppo Jews said no. They did not see history in this way at all. They were not, for the most part, Zionists, and they might have been kicked out of Aleppo, but they had not come to subsume themselves into this narrative of Jewish history. They had guarded this codex for 600 years and believed that it was theirs. It belonged to their community. It had been their symbol. And the trial is about that, and it unfolds over 4 years, and it includes a lot of fascinating testimony, and it's largely the trial that helped me put the whole story together.
Including the part about how the difference between the courier bringing it to be to go into the hands of somebody that can protect it, and what appears to be the story, which is the government of Israel essentially giving this guy an offer he couldn't resist to turn it over to them.
In some form, yes.
Yeah, in some form.
Yep.
Ted is in San Diego, Wildcard Line on Coast to Coast AM for Maddie Friedman, author of this fascinating book on the hitherto untold story of the Aleppo Codex. Ted?
Hey, fascinating is right. This is a great show, guys. You know, I wanted to ask about the Torah codes and what effect this would have. This has been like a really exciting year for Torah stuff all over. And they've been releasing online, I think it was like 100 codes were just recently discovered, where they say they've actually found the name of the Messiah. And, you know, in Daniel 12, it says that the scroll was to be sealed up until the time of the end. So, you know, a lot of us that are active Torah code researchers get really excited when stuff like this happens. And now your guest finding this or speaking about this new version, we're wondering what effect this could have on it.
I'd be reluctant to use the word new version. Go ahead. Do you want to address that real quick, Maddie, on the idea
that's true. It's not a new version. It's a very old version, but it also is the most accurate version. And there's all kinds of beliefs inside Judaism associated with the perfection of the text, meaning that every letter has to be exactly right. And it would have an effect on this subject, whatever the theological or scientific veracity of the Bible code, if there were different spellings of words or different words. The differences in the Aleppo Codex, let's put it this way, between the Aleppo Codex and a Hebrew Bible that you'll find in your average synagogue are very, very minute, and they're mostly differences that have to do with vowels and with what's known as cantillation, which is the melody to which the text is chanted, which is also very important because it serves as punctuation. In a few cases, there are letters that are in the Aleppo Codex that are not in the average Bible. There's a very small number of words in the text that are spelled slightly differently in the codex, meaning that that is the accurate spelling, and the Bibles that are in use, the Hebrew Bibles that are in use, include minor errors. So anyone interested in the perfection of the text for whatever reason needs to get as close as possible to the text in the Aleppo Codex. Of course, what makes that difficult to do is that we're missing 40% of the Aleppo Codex, including the Torah.
Yeah.
So
very interesting. We'll continue to watch that story. The idea of a Messiah's name being revealed, I'll I'll watch that too. Ed is in Allentown. We'll get to him coming up next on Coast to Coast. We still have a half hour. And Maddie Friedman, the author of The Aleppo Codex, The True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible. Find out more by linking up to him at coasttocoastam.com. So great stories waiting for you at coasttocoastam.com. If you go there, sign up for the Coast to Coast Twitter feed. I had Tim send out a link to a casting call that was looking for people who have had strange and supernatural experiences to audition for a national television show. It's right up your alley. Go take a look at that so that you can get those Twitter feeds from coasttocoastam.com and also from me, at Deacon Punnett. We'll keep in touch during the week. The Aleppo Codex, The True Story of Obsession, Faith, and the Pursuit of an Ancient Bible. We'll get to our last questions for Maddie Friedman coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so it's Coast to Coast AM, and we've got time to get to Ed in Allentown, Pennsylvania, on a wildcard line for Maddie Friedman, The Aleppo Codex. Ed?
Good morning, Deacon Punnett.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Maddie.
Good morning.
Good to hear your voice on the air again. Hope you do a lot more shows soon. Fantastic show. I have a compound question and a comment. Oddly enough, the Israeli government offered to treat medically some of the Syrian victims of this horrible rampaging that's been going on there, with civilians dying in a bloody feud that nobody knows where it comes from. I tried calling the show the other day when Alex Jones was on, to take him to task for writing anti-Israel articles saying that they're behind it, which I think is totally ludicrous. And, of course, he's been carrying Arab Muslim writers saying these things, these accusations against Israel, which are really petty.
I hadn't heard anything about that either way.
Anyway, my question is, how do the codexes, what's left of them, compare to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are probably 1,000 years older than the Codex? Wouldn't they be more, you know, to the point and accurate? And also, in 1917, I read online, which you can also read the Codex entirely, digitally. Someone has it up there if you look it up. I read online that in 1917, a Jewish Orthodox a rabbinical society member took photographs of the Codex in total. And I was wondering if Maddie knew anything about that, and has there been any other translation since? Has anybody copied it in other forms?
Really interesting.
Those are two great questions, actually. Let's start with the second one. The Codex has never been photographed in its entirety. There was no photography done before it was supposedly lost in 1947. Individual pages were photographed in the 1800s. Just a very few pages. One of the people who did it was, if I'm not mistaken, a divinity scholar from Oxford, who's given pretty rare access to the manuscript. But he only photographed one or two pages. So no photographs exist of the entire manuscript. It was finally photographed and made available in 1976. So today, you can actually buy a copy, a facsimile copy of the Aleppo Codex. And you can also, as you mentioned, which is very helpful, see it online. I can't remember the web address at the moment, but you can find it on Google. They've put up very beautiful high-res photographs of every page of the Codex, and you can flip through it, and it's quite amazing. The beauty of the manuscript is not in its illuminations or in its gold leaf or in its fancy binding. It doesn't have any of those things. There are no illustrations. There's nothing fancy about it. All it is page after page of very meticulous, beautiful Hebrew writing. And I like that. And as I write in the book, the Codex is not a manuscript that begs for your attention. It doesn't go out of its way. There are no bells and whistles. There are no fireworks. It doesn't need anything except its content. And that's quite amazing. As for the first question, also an excellent question. Of course, as Nicole pointed out, the Dead Sea Scrolls predate the Aleppo Codex by about 1,000 years. But the Dead Sea Scrolls don't have canonical significance in Judaism. The Dead Sea Scrolls include many, many thousands of manuscripts, some of which exist in their entirety and some of which exist merely as fragments. And they also include different versions of biblical books include fragments of all of the books of the Hebrew Bible, with the exception of the book of Esther. And in some cases, they include versions that differ quite considerably from the version that we now have in the Hebrew Bible, with one of the most striking examples being the book of Jeremiah, which exists in two different versions in the Dead Sea Scrolls, one of which is 1/7 longer than the other version. In terms of the importance to the Jewish religion, the Aleppo Codex is far more important than the Dead Sea Scrolls, because the Aleppo Codex is the perfect version, as far as Jews are concerned, of their Bible. The Dead Sea Scrolls might be significant, and are significant, certainly, to historians and to people who are interested in Second Temple era Judaism and into the early years of Christianity, and the Dead Sea Scrolls have a lot to teach us about that. But in terms of the perfect text of the Hebrew Bible, as far as the Jewish religion is concerned, the Aleppo Codex is the most important book, and the Dead Sea Scrolls aren't that significant.
Although, if you were to look for significance in the comparison in terms of its canonical stature, the Isaiah scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls, it has a different place, right? I mean, it is in a select place in Jerusalem that you can go see just that, the Isaiah scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls?
It's not always on display, but I was lucky enough to see it. I believe it was a year or two ago they put it on display at the Israel Museum. They rotate the Dead Sea Scrolls for reasons of conservation. They're not on display all the time, or they would become damaged. But the Isaiah scroll is also just a beautiful thing to look at. And yeah, it is held in Jerusalem. And if you're lucky enough to visit Jerusalem, you can visit the Dead Sea Scrolls at the Israel Museum. And there's something to see.
I had read once, and this may not be true, that the Isaiah scroll is in a specially designed display that if the ground shakes even a little bit, if there's enough of a vibration of, say, of a missile attack or anything else, that the Isaiah scroll automatically drops down into a vault that should be able to withstand even a nuclear blast.
I haven't heard that, but I can certainly check. The scholar who runs the shrine of the book is a friend of mine, and I'll ask him. Certainly, the security precautions at that place are quite incredible, and the manuscripts there enjoy state of the art conditions, both in terms of day to day maintenance and in terms of preservation in the case of an emergency.
Yeah, I check on that, but I think that's pretty accurate, that for fire or anything else, it automatically drops into a vault. Mark is in Teaneck, New Jersey, on Coast to Coast for Maddie Friedman, author of the Aleppo Codex.
Yeah, hi. How you doing, gentlemen?
Great. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a religious Orthodox Jew, and I had a question as follows. I know that today you go to any synagogue, any religious synagogue in the world, and the version of the Torah is quite accurate. In other words, first of all, in the layout of the text, it's almost exact in every single the same word at the top of every column is exact. And not only that, you said the cancellation, the trup, as it's called, is so exact. There's only one cancellation mark, which is a point of the scholars argue about it. It's only one of them in the five books of Moses. Everything else, any Jew anywhere has the same exact tradition. So what is the significance, other than the historical treasure of this Aleppo Codex, what would be the significance of finding the extra pages today? What changes would be as a result of that?
Really good question.
Yeah, an excellent question. There are hundreds of minute, mostly minute, not only minute, differences between the Codex and the books of the Bible that exist in most synagogues. I'm talking about printed Bibles that include all the books, not the Torah scroll. And these hundreds of variations are perhaps not of day-to-day importance to people who are practicing Jews, but are very important to people who study the Bible and want to reach the perfect version of the biblical text. As for the Torah scroll, there are minute variations in Torah scrolls, and that's a very interesting subject in itself. The Torah scroll is used by European Jews and Sephardic Jews, so Jews who are of Eastern descent or who have origins in Spain, are the same, but there are minor differences between those Torah scrolls and Torah scrolls, for example, used by Jews from Yemen. And there's one word, for example, in the biblical story of Noah, where there's actually a letter that is written in Yemenite Torah scrolls and not written in Sephardic and an Ashkenazic or European Torah scrolls. And in this case, the Codex makes it clear that the Yemenites have a more accurate copy.
How about that?
A copy of the Bible that is closer to the Codex. And again, it's not that there are biblical stories in the Codex that we don't have. It's not that there's an 11th commandment. There's no hidden stories. But the perfection of the text is a matter of huge importance to Jews. And that makes these seemingly minute differences very, very important.
Wait. The 11th commandment, thou shalt not put mayonnaise on corned beef, that's not actually in the Bible?
I have to check again. You know, that one might be in there.
Check that one. I think they found that. First time caller Jerry is in Billings, Montana on Coast to Coast. Jerry?
Hey, amazing. I can't believe 5 years I've been trying to get through, and tonight, just first call, boom, there I am.
Very glad we got you in before the end of the show.
Yeah, a little bit nervous, but I'm going to run this off. You know, I started in about an hour late on the show, but I don't worry about it because the work that I do, I'm out here all night long so I can catch it when it starts over.
Good.
But the point is, I did miss the first hour, so I don't know if this was brought up or not. But now, you said that there's quite a few of these codecs that are missing, or somebody's holding on to them, right?
There's one codex, but the chapters within it are still missing, yes.
Yeah. And obviously, if these people were going to release them, they would have done it by now, you would think, right?
It's safe to assume that if someone wanted to make them public, they would have been made public.
Yeah. Well, I often get these little inspirations while I'm listening to the show, but trying to get through and deliver my words of wisdom don't always happen. This is the first time it has happened. Do you think it would be possible that you could put out an appeal to these people that are holding on to these to anonymously take copies? Can these things be copied?
Yep.
To anonymously take copies of them and send them to you.
That's
tell
a good...
them you'll pay the freight or whatever on them, but just so you can get them, you know?
That's a fantastic idea. And why don't we make the appeal right now? You know.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, people, listen. This is you're out there close to
you know, a lot of people listen to the show. Who knows?
And
someone's listening and looking at the missing pages of the Aleppo Codex.
And they could easily be in Brooklyn, as we talked about. So
right. Who knows where they are? But certainly, I mean, if anyone has pages. And, you know, they may not even want to give the pages back, but they could make a copy of the pages.
Sure.
And they could get in touch, certainly, with me or with the Israel Museum or with the Institute, which is the custodian of the Codex. People will be very, very happy to hear from them, and I'm sure that something can be arranged so that their identity is never made public.
You know, that's, again, interesting just from the official, even from the State of Israel, to send that out saying, look, no questions asked. Can you send us copies? You know, drop them off at this lemonade stand in downtown, you know, Tel Aviv.
Right, in an unmarked
envelope. No questions asked. Somebody will just say thank you, and that's it. And that would be great to get them back. Let's get to Rose in Phoenix. As we wind things down on Coast to Coast for Maddie Friedman, author of the Aleppo Codex, great book. Rose?
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Yes, I really understand what you're talking about, the importance of finding the Codex, because it's a more exact translation of what Jesus was saying. But my question to you is, wasn't Aramaic the original language that Jesus spoke?
Well, you're again, I think you're conflating things, but I understand what you're saying. So the Aleppo Codex is all in Hebrew, and it is of the first, the missing ones are the first five books of the Bible, and the only thing we're talking about there is Hebrew scriptures. Yes, Jesus would have spoken Aramaic. Aramaic was the spoken language. Hebrew was much more commonly written by that time, but this isn't specifically what Maddie was talking about, just so you know. But that does pertain back to other things, because It was interesting to see that there was a number, there was a long period of time, and I didn't know this until I read your book, that almost all Jews in the Middle East only spoke Arabic.
Certainly their native language was Arabic, and they lived very much in Arabic, and they had names that were Arab, and they were very much a part of the local landscape. And I wasn't aware of it, you know, until I started researching this story. I mean, I always knew that there Jews, there have been Jews who lived in the Middle East. I never really understood to what extent. I'm talking about a million people in the mid-20th century, a million Jews in the Islamic world, almost all of whom are gone. And they were very much a part of the Arab world until the climate became very inhospitable in the mid 20th century. Their ritual language, of course, was Hebrew. Jews have to have their ritual in Hebrew. You can't read the Torah in the synagogue in another language. You have to read it in Hebrew. Translations are not, you can certainly help yourself by reading a translation, but the ritual reading of the Bible has to be in Hebrew, and the prayers are always in Hebrew. So, and that is the same in Jewish communities, whether you're talking about Bangkok or Casablanca or Poland. But their day-to-day language was Arabic. They woke up and drank coffee and went to work in Arabic.
Yeah, that's the difference. I mean, but you can have like a, what I refer to as a bar mitzvah level understanding of Hebrew, and you can then also spend your whole life talking another language, but you can have enough to get by when you're in the temple. But that's the part that I thought was interesting, is that was how much of the Jewish world, when Israel was created, it also meant the resurrection of Hebrew as a spoken day-to-day language.
That's right, which was not the case before. I mean, before the early 20th century, no one spoke Hebrew. It was a language of rituals, a language used in synagogue.
The formal
text in Hebrew. You might read the Bible in Hebrew, but then when you closed your Bible and went to, you know, talk to your mother, and then you would speak to her in Polish or Russian or English or Arabic. And what's happened, one of the most amazing things about the Jewish national revival has been the revival of Hebrew as a spoken language. My children speak Hebrew. That's their native language. And no one thinks it's strange anymore. Only 100 years ago, this would have been just unbelievable.
Unheard of.
Would be born speaking the language of the Bible. And I still, sometimes I can't get over it when I hear them, you know, fighting or, you know, playing with Lego in Hebrew. That's a dead language that has been brought to life, and it's quite incredible.
Will, you get the last question here just before we have a minute for you. Will from Madison, for Maddie Friedman. Go ahead, Will.
Thank you for taking my call, Eden. And it's a great pleasure to speak to Matti Friedman, who has done one of the greatest pieces of writing in the world. I'm glad that I'm alive to hear what you have to say. I hypothesize why the five books of Moses are missing. Answer is, they have the evidence that the original native tongue of the indigenous peoples along the eastern coast of the Mediterranean and Egypt were, in fact, Finno-Ugric. And Jesus spoke, his mother tongue was most likely a Finno-Ugric tongue akin to Estonian or Finnish. And
We'll have to leave that there. That's all we have time for. And I know that's what I knew you were going to go there because you always go there. But maybe that's why the five books are missing, was because it was going to prove that point. We'll just have to wait and see whether you turn out to be right. The Aleppo Codex, the true story of obsession, faith, and the pursuit of an ancient Bible. Maddie Friedman, enjoyed our time very much. I guess it's about noon where you are, right?
That's right. It's 12 o'clock.
In Jerusalem. Well, God bless you, and I hope you have a peaceful week. And thank you so much for your kind attention to detail, both in the book and in the way in which you handled the conversation on the air. And I look forward to getting an update from you. So if you actually do start to hear back from people who are going to turn back in their lucky fragments or whatever else they have with the Aleppo Codex, would you please reach out and let us know?
Certainly let you know. And thanks so much for having me on the show.
Okay. God bless you. Thank you so much. Baruch Hashem. And I hope everybody else has a terrific week, too. And I hope you're off to a great start with a fun summer. We'll be back in a month. In the meantime, please keep in touch via Twitter, at Deacon Punnett, DEACONPUNNETT. Deus Tamat. And I do, too.